We're going to be dealing with the question of disparities in healthcare, a topic that has many aspects. We have three people to make presentations on this panel, and they are... If you will excuse me if I mispronounce your names, I think I can do this, but we'll see. Iris Gonzalez, Senior Attorney of AARP Foundation Litigation. David Maklet, Senior Policy Analyst, National Health Law Program. And Jessica Roberts, Associate Professor, George Butler Research Professor of Law, and Director, Health Law and Policy Institute of the University of Houston Law Center. Which one of you would like to begin?
Jessica Roberts.
Okay, so the last shall be first. Here is Jessica Roberts.
Good morning. Thank you so much to the organizers. I'm delighted and honored to be here with you all today. So, as was mentioned, I'm Jessica Roberts. I'm the George Butler Research Professor and the Director of Health Law and Policy at the University of Houston Law Center. And I will kick off this panel on disparities in healthcare by talking about some of the historical issues people with disabilities have faced and the way in which the Affordable Care Act specifically attempted to address at least some of those issues. So I will set the tone for the panel, and then my co-panelists will speak at greater length about the effectiveness of these changes in actually reducing many of these disparities. So first, people with disabilities as a group are at greater health risk than people without disabilities. So according to the CDC, as compared to people without disabilities, people with disabilities are more likely to be affected by certain social factors, health-related behaviors, and they experience a general lack of access to health care. Specifically, adults with a disability are more likely to be unemployed, they're more likely to be a victim of a violent crime. With respect to disease, they're more likely to have cardiovascular problems, to be obese, to be smokers, and to engage in little leisure time physical activity. And finally, because of this lack of health care access, adults with a disability are less likely to have a current mammogram, or they are also more likely to be unable to access needed health care because of costs. Additionally, according to the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, compared with individuals without disabilities, individuals with disabilities are less likely to receive recommended preventative health care services, such as routine teeth cleanings and cancer screenings. They're at higher risk for poor health outcomes, such as obesity, hypertension, injuries, and mood disorders like depression. And they're more likely to engage in unhealthy behaviors that put their health at risk, such as cigarette smoking and inadequate physical activity. Now, because of these heightened health risks, access to healthcare is particularly relevant to people with disabilities. However, they've historically had difficulty accessing healthcare. As noted, they have greater difficulty gaining access to preventative services. Also, when people with disabilities are successful in securing healthcare access, they frequently have poorer health outcomes than people without disabilities. And they must deal with potential biases with medical professionals. So research has shown that medical professionals may hold stereotypical beliefs that lead to certain behaviors and assumptions when they're dealing with patients with disabilities. They might not want to treat certain individuals with disabilities, and they might underestimate the quality of life that's actually experienced by individuals with disabilities. Now, these access issues have been further exacerbated by many of the traditional practices of the private for-profit health insurance industry. Pre-existing condition exclusions allowed insurers to actively discriminate against individuals with disability, as did health status-based underwriting and rating practices, allowed insurers to either exclude coverage for individuals with disabilities altogether or to charge more for individuals with disabilities, sometimes charging so much that it was prohibitively expensive to obtain health insurance, and even popular provisions like cost sharing, things like copays, could have a negative impact on individuals with disabilities who may need to access more healthcare. So a $40 copay seems a lot less reasonable if you're going to the doctor multiple times a week. So despite these realities, people with disabilities have historically not been recognized as a health disparities population. Now, being recognized as a health disparities population is important because that recognition allows governments to take steps to actively reduce inequalities. In the past 5 to 10 years, there's been greater effort to address disparities in healthcare faced by people with disabilities. But one of the questions that I want to tackle in my presentation this morning is why it has taken us so long to recognize that there are serious disparities in healthcare related to disability. In some of my scholarship, I have proposed that traditionally, lawmakers have understood the laws that apply to people with disabilities as being two separate canons, one canon of law being health laws and the other being civil rights laws. Under the umbrella of health law, we find things like social welfare benefits, so programs like Medicare and Medicaid that provide benefits to people. These kinds of laws are not traditionally viewed as an instrument of equality or access. They're more frequently construed as entitlements. Now, another type of a health-related law is insurance law. While insurance laws may impact individuals with disabilities, typically that is not necessarily the goal. Insurance laws are often designed to regulate markets, to provide consistency and transparency. And finally, public health law is another form of health law, and this is designed to promote population health. And frequently in the context of disability, individuals' disabilities have been the object of public health law in terms of prevention versus being viewed as a population that could be served by public health law. So those are the health-related laws. We have social welfare benefits, we have insurance law, and we have public health law. And that's been a separate set of legal protections, typically, than what we would call civil rights laws. Now, civil rights laws are laws where the primary goal is to address issues of access and equality, often for a particular group. Of course, in the disability context, the most well-recognized civil rights laws federally are the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act. Now, some reasons why health law and civil rights law might have been construed as separate in the past might have to do with how we understand health versus disability. If any of you are familiar with the World Health Organization's definition of health, they define health as, quote, a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity, end quote. When I teach health law, I tell my students that if this is the definition of health, I personally have never experienced it. So, with that kind of a definition of health in terms of health promotion, and then the legal definition of disability being a substantially limiting impairment, a record of that kind of impairment, or being regarded as having that impairment, you might see how lawmakers might find health and disability to be incompatible or in opposition. And this might explain the failure that we've had in the past to include people with disabilities in health disparities research. Also, too, possibly responsible, at least in part, for this divide could be the disability rights movement itself. The social model of disability worked very hard to demedicalize disability and focus on the social aspects of exclusion. Also, by rejecting paternalism, we separated disability rights from entitlements. So these are potential explanations for why these two areas of law have not come together. But that's not to say that civil rights law do not apply to healthcare. Just that they've not successfully eliminated the disparities individuals with disabilities face in healthcare. Now, I'll say a little bit about the federal statutes that apply to the healthcare context specifically. So the Rehabilitation Act, which covers federally funded entities, would apply to healthcare providers that accept Medicare and Medicaid and other kinds of federal funding, things like grants. Of course, Title II of the ADA, which applies to state and local government, would apply to a healthcare provider that's owned or operated by a public entity or under contract with the state, for example, receiving funds from a state Medicaid agency. And final, Title III of the ADA covers public accommodations. And specifically, in the language of that statute, it provides that, quote, professional office of a healthcare provider, hospital, or other service establishment, end quote, is an example of a covered public accommodation. So despite the fact that these civil rights laws apply to healthcare, they did not adequately address issues of people with disabilities have faced in accessing healthcare. First, there's something that Sam Bagenstos has called the access content distinction. So this holds that as long as a given program or public accommodation provides meaningful access to a benefit, it need not provide an equal outcome. So an example would be that as long as a health insurer offers the same product to all of their insureds, the relative utility of the product doesn't matter. They would not violate the ADA. Also, the Rehabilitation Act has limited application to claims for unintentional discrimination. So this means that even if cutting federal funding to a program would have a disparate impact on individuals with disabilities, that doesn't mean that they can use the law to seek recourse. And then the private enforcement mechanisms of many of these civil rights laws actually undermine the ability of people with disabilities to make a large, meaningful impact, at least with respect to public health and some of the entitlements. So individual litigants have to file their claims, and this is something that requires motivated people to go and take the time and often the large expense to file lawsuits. And we might see the ability of individuals with disabilities to file claims even further limited now that we have the ADA Education and Reform Act that passed the House with a vote of 225 to 192. And then finally, in disability law, we have the direct threat doctrine, which allows entities to treat people differently as long as there's a significant risk of substantial harm to the individual or to others. And this might be used as an excuse for a medical provider not to provide care to an individual with a certain type of disability. So the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act have fallen short in the healthcare context. Now, to eliminate disparities and improve healthcare access, I've argued that we need an alternate paradigm. Because health disparities are a health issue, addressing them requires a health law solution. Now, while not viewed as such, the Affordable Care Act actually constitutes one of the most substantial civil rights victories for people with disabilities in recent history. It's an example of something that we would consider traditionally a health law doing the work of civil rights by providing for access and equality. Now, this is not a huge surprise. Advocates pushed Congress to consider the health disparities faced by the disability community when Congress was drafting the Affordable Care Act. One particular example is advocates argued for understanding things in terms of, quote, the universal, quote, prism of disability. In other words, if the law that Congress passed was good enough for people with disabilities, it will probably be good enough for all Americans. Now, in addition, grassroots organizing and coalition building took place on a large scale. There was a consortium for citizens with disabilities that had over 100 national cross-disability organizations. Faith-based organizations also lobbied on behalf of individuals with disabilities. And we saw a coming together of disability rights groups and rights groups for the aging population that had not historically happened. The result, then, is that the Affordable Care Act contains many provisions that have a positive impact on healthcare access for individuals with disabilities. And I'll go through a few examples of what some of those provisions are. First, the insurance non-discrimination rules hold great promise for individuals with disabilities, eliminating pre-existing conditions. So the law provides that, quote, a group health plan and a health insurance issuer offering a group or individual health insurance coverage may not impose any pre-existing condition exclusion with respect to such plan or coverage. Now, of course, this is one of the Affordable Care Act's most popular provisions, and in so doing, by eliminating pre-existing condition exclusions, we can get rid of some of that historical discrimination that people with disabilities have experienced in terms of accessing affordable health insurance. Also, the Affordable Care Act prohibits discriminatory premium rates. So health insurers in the individual and small group markets can't use health status when setting rates anymore. As of 2014, health insurers in that market must rely on other factors, mainly whether the plan offers individual or group coverage, the location of where the individual is living, that individual's age, and whether or not that person uses tobacco. And then finally, the Affordable Care Act prohibits discrimination. Group and individual insurers cannot use health status when making eligibility decisions. So not only can we not use health status in rating, we can't use it in deciding whether or not to offer a policy in the first place. So these rules could give people with disabilities access to more meaningful health insurance coverage. Another particularly important aspect of the Affordable Care Act for people with disabilities are its provisions dealing with accessible medical equipment. Now, at the beginning of my presentation, I mentioned that people with disabilities experience barriers obtaining routine preventative care, and inaccessible medical equipment is one of the reasons why. It might be possible that there are inaccessible scales, mammogram machines, x-ray equipment, exam tables, et cetera. So pursuant to the Affordable Care Act, the Access Board issued standards for medical diagnostic equipment in January of last year, using a collaborative process similar to the one it used developing guidelines with regard to the ADA. However, at present, these standards are not mandatory. The DOJ can opt to adopt them as mandatory. However, right now, they're something that is instructive for providers as well as for the entities that manufacture medical device equipment. Another important aspect of the Affordable Care Act has to do with health disparities research. I also mentioned that individuals with disabilities are not historically considered a health disparities population for the purposes of public health law. However, the Affordable Care Act is among the first federal legislation to actually recognize people with disabilities as a health disparities population. This means that they can get access to federally funded or supported health programs, and that those programs must collect and report data on disability. Specifically, HHS will collect data on where people with disabilities access care, the availability of accessible facilities and medical equipment, and disability awareness training for providers to try to eliminate some of that bias. These data collection initiatives will then allow us to use that information to create initiatives that could hopefully reduce some of the disparities that individuals with disabilities experience in the context of healthcare access. Other parts of the Affordable Care Act that have a positive impact on people with disabilities include the creation of a healthcare anti-discrimination right in the form of Section 1557, which one of my co-panelists will discuss, as well as changes to the Medicaid program, which is the largest source of health insurance for people with disabilities. But I will leave that to my co-panelists. The important takeaway from my presentation is that threats to the Affordable Care Act and other programs seriously put the rights of people with disabilities in peril. This administration that focuses on wellness outcomes could disadvantage people with disabilities. If we dial back data reporting provisions, that means that we'll have less access to data and be unable to track those disparities that we've already long neglected. So the happy part of my presentation is that the Affordable Care Act shows us that we can use these other forms of law, things like healthcare, to actually further civil rights. We can use health law as an instrument to provide improved access and greater equality for people with disabilities. However, in the current contentious political climate, where some of those health laws are under attack, that might be a substantial rollback for individuals with disabilities. So thank you so much for your time. I'm excited for your questions. And again, I'm Jessica Roberts at the University of Houston Law Center. Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate that. And who do we have coming up? Oh, right. Iris Gonzalez is now senior attorney at the AARP. Here she is.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for having me. So speaking right after Jessica here is provides a really smooth transition into what I was going to talk about. I just want to add to her comments and say that I think that there is another sort of big provision of the Affordable Care Act that would help in eliminating health disparities, and that's the fact that it increases the risk pool, or theoretically increases the risk pool in the private insurance market. And as she mentioned, that is, under attack. We know that there have been a lot of regulatory actions and inactions that have weakened the individual market and the exchanges. And so shoring that up and ensuring that it works how it was intended to work in the long term is a big step toward ensuring that all of the pieces of the puzzle are together, of all the different tools that the ACA was supposed to provide to reduce health disparities. But I'm going to talk about a more specific and obvious tool, and that is Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as the non-discrimination provision. The basic elements of Section 1557 are that it creates a private right of action with the availability of compensatory damages for the exclusion of participation in denial of benefits or discrimination based on race, national origin, sex, age, and disability. And that is in any health program or activity, and this is how it's written in the statute, any part of which is receiving federal financial assistance, including credits, subsidies, or contracts of insurance under any program or activity that is administered by an executive agency or any entitlement established under this title. So a health program or activity is defined pretty broadly, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit later when I get into the details. However, the regulations, not the statute itself, the regulations exclude Medicare Part B from the definition of health program or activity. And for now, I'll say that AARP disagrees with this interpretation of the statute and so stated in its comments to the proposed regulations. So what legal standards apply to Section 1557? Well, the statute itself references and incorporates the four civil rights statutes that deal with national origin, race, sex, age discrimination, and disability discrimination. With respect to disability discrimination, it references and incorporates Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And so the legal standards for proving a violation of Section 1557 and the remedies are, as we'll see in my discussion of the cases that have been brought so far and in the interpretation given by the regulations, they're the same ones that apply to those analogous statutes. So in essence, a claim for disability discrimination under Section 1557 is analyzed under the same legal framework as a claim for disability discrimination under Section 504 of the Rehab Act. The regulations similarly require reasonable accommodation to avoid discrimination, and of course it has the fundamental alteration defense in there. And the regulations and the executive order on preemption tell us that state laws that prevent its application are preempted, and that's very important. So given that we're looking at the same legal standards that apply in Section 504 cases, the question is, what is the added value of Section 1557? Well, I'd argue that that has two added values. The most explicit one is that it applies to private insurers on the exchanges. Because of the availability of credits and subsidies to any insurer that is offering health insurance on the exchanges, they come under the fold. And the other value is that it explicitly recognizes that we're looking at discrimination in the provision of or any program or activity that is connected to providing health services. And that's a broader interpretation than many of the courts have given to the protections of Section 504. It applies to an entity if any part of the entity receives federal funding, even if the person that's complaining of discrimination does not benefit from that specific program that gets the federal funding or doesn't participate in the program that gets the federal funding. The key is, if any part of the organization receives the federal funding, it falls under the ambit of Section 1557. So there are some opportunities to improve the reach of Section 1557, and I'll discuss those more later. And to sort of frame up what I see as opportunities to improve the reach of 1557, I want to talk about the litigation that we've seen so far on Section 1557 claims. So there have, been roughly 30-plus cases that brought some kind of a Section 1557 claim, a little bit like under 20, 19 or 20, that actually had any sort of substantive ruling dealing with Section 1557. So the types of discrimination that have been alleged, a lot of them are sex discrimination, some are race discrimination, and then there have been eight of them that have a claim of disability discrimination. And some of these have more than one claim. So you have disability and sex discrimination, or in another case, you had disability and race discrimination. So on the eight disability discrimination claims, four of those were for a hospital or clinic's failure to provide appropriate auxiliary aids to deaf patients. One was an HIV/AIDS discrimination claim. That claim was essentially that a scheme that resulted in the higher price of drugs, of HIV drugs, had a disparate impact on people with this disability. That theory didn't survive, and I'll talk about a little bit more about that later. And then so the other disability claims were dealing with gender dysphoria, and that one is a little bit complicated because the interpretation of what constitutes sex discrimination, that's really what has led to the more extensive litigation and appellate practice with Section 1557, because you're going back to, you know, Title VII and how, you know, sex discrimination is interpreted there. So that gets a little bit more complicated. But essentially in that decision, they just basically said that gender dysphoria is not a disability. That's the ruling when it comes to disability in that case. Another one was agoraphobia and PTSD as a disability. And then another one was about Hep C. And again, this is the pricing for Hep C drugs. And this is another case that tried to bring a disparate impact theory of liability. If you increase the prices of drugs that are specifically to treat a certain chronic condition or a disabling condition, it has a disparate impact on people with disabilities. But those theories have not survived. But the case law is ambiguous right now as to whether a disparate impact theory could be successful under Section 1557. So, you know, what is the status of these cases? I mean, they started being filed pretty early on. Even the regulations became effective in the summer of 2016, but the provision was effective before then. And some cases were brought before the regs came out. So there's a little bit of, you know, in a few cases, there's a little bit of inconsistency in how the courts interpret the statute, because they didn't have the benefit of the regulations at the time. And so we see that there are some differing interpretations after the regs came out. A few of these cases have settled usually they settle after a good opinion on a motion to dismiss, where the case isn't dismissed, most of them are still in litigation. I haven't seen any that have gone to trial verdicts or judgments. So what are the takeaways from the litigation we've seen so far? Well, the case law primarily tells us what claims will survive motions to dismiss. We've had one summary judgment decision, and that's the one that I alluded to earlier. The summary judgment was that gender dysphoria was not a disability. In addition to no trial verdicts or judgments, there are also no class actions yet that have survived. So courts are applying the same legal standards for the four civil rights statutes that are referenced in Section 1557, including Section 504, and there's no definitive answer on whether this permits disparate impact claims, which I think is really important. Compensatory damages are available if you can prove intentional discrimination, and it's important to note that the way that the term intentional is used in the case law, it doesn't mean that you have to prove animus or malice. But that's in there. If you can prove that the discrimination was intentional, there's the availability of compensatory damages. And of course, as we know, the state is not immune from suit because they can't contract out their non-discrimination duty. So state entities that contract with a private entity to provide health services are liable when that private entity denies people with disabilities equal access. So some of the potential litigation strategies that I see sort of going forward with Section 1557, I mean, it has its inherent limitations, but I think for those of us who are out there doing impact litigation, bringing cases, those of us who are serving individuals in a legal services capacity, I ask you to sort of keep your eyes and ears open for these types of situations, because we really want to test the limits of this provision. We need to see whether a disparate impact theory of liability can be sustained. And I think that's really important, because the two cases that even brought up a disparate impact theory of liability, the decisions were on motions to dismiss, and the judges didn't really deal well with that theory. They didn't analyze it well. In one of the cases, it seemed like the judge didn't really understand what a disparate impact theory was. So It was about, I can't remember which drug it was, but it was about drug pricing. I think it was the HIV drug one. And he said, well, the discrimination, the prices of the drugs are higher, not because they're for people with disabilities, but because of X, Y, Z, you know, and he gave a bunch of factors. I'm like, well, that's exactly what disparate impact theory is about, facially neutral. So I'm like, well, I'm not really sure that this is good guidance to go on here. It just seemed like, you know, the judge didn't understand the nature of the theory. And then another case, it was one in which the judge said, well, there are differences of opinion about whether disparate impact theory could survive, and different circuit courts have dealt with it differently, but I don't need to decide that here because I can decide this case on another ground. And so that's why I think that there is still potential to push this theory and test its limits. And I think it's really important because really a disparate impact theory of liability is what will get at the policies, the procedures, and the practices that are facially neutral but really affect people's access to quality health care and the affordability of that health care. Another opportunity for potential litigation is to challenge the court's narrow interpretation of associational disability. This is something that associational disability discrimination. This is something that came up in a couple of cases where the parent of a person with disabilities who passed away brought a claim on their behalf, on their own behalf, and on behalf of the estate of the person with the disability. And so, you know, the defendants brought up that, well, she doesn't have standing to bring up her own claim because she's not the person with the disability. So there is, you know, there is an associational disability discrimination theory that is recognized under the ADA and Section 504. But interestingly here, so the ADA's definition is stricter. You know, you have to show that as the person claiming associational disability discrimination that an actual benefit was denied to you too, right? And so what the courts, you know, at least one court has done is said, well, I'm going to take the ADA's definition and use it here, even though Section 504 doesn't have a definition, but it's been interpreted more broadly. And I think that's really interesting because Section 1557 doesn't reference and incorporate the ADA. It references and incorporates Section 504 of the Rehab Act. So there's some selective picking and choosing that's going on here, and I think that that kind of interpretation should be challenged in good cases. You know, some other potential litigation strategies include testing sort of the intersection of age and disability. When I read sort of, you know, the text of Section 1557, you know, at the beginning of my presentation, the word age was in there, right? Age discrimination is also actionable. But the statute that that it references and incorporates is the Age Discrimination Act of 1975, and really, I don't know, I just think that that statute has no teeth. Like, it's not been used. There's no, virtually no case law on it. It has really cumbersome and onerous administrative remedy exhaustion provisions. And so I don't see, you know, how you could ever bring an age discrimination case if what the courts do is continue to say, to follow the trend that they've been following and saying, well, we have to go by the legal standards of these, you know, other, that have been applied to these other civil rights statutes. So that's something that that should be explored more, and I think is of particular interest because of the practical intersectionality of age and disability, and there's two ways that happens, right? As you all know, right? People with disabilities are living longer. And so then they get to the point later in their lives when they have to deal with the double whammy of disability discrimination and age discrimination, because there's a lot of ageism that really affects the access to and the quality of healthcare that older people get. And both for people with disabilities and older persons, there's a bias that affects them, that the bias is that the value of their lives isn't as much as someone who is seen as able and younger, right? So this intersection, I think, is one that should be explored, possibly in a case that alleges both age and disability discrimination. And I think an area that is particularly suited for testing those parameters is long-term care, assisted living, a lot of assisted living now in many states. They take Medicaid through the form of Medicaid waivers for folks, and you know, fingers crossed, AARP Foundation will soon be filing a claim in an assisted living context with a Section 1557 claim and other disability rights and housing law claims. So trying to test sort of where this goes. Now, our plaintiff doesn't receive Medicaid. She doesn't benefit from the Medicaid waiver, but the facility takes Medicaid waiver payments, and so we're bringing them into the fold that way. Another area that I think would be interesting to explore in terms of the intersection between age and disability discrimination is, you know, something that we've been working on at AARP Foundation for a while, is trying to stop the inappropriate use of antipsychotic drugs in nursing facilities, and this deals with cognitive disabilities. Antipsychotic drugs are, you know, often given sort of as the first go-to for people who have some form of dementia impairment, basically because there isn't enough or appropriately trained staff to deal sort of with the behavioral challenges that come with dementia. And so I think there that there is a dual bias or dual discrimination going on there, because there is a cognitive impairment, there is a disability there, but also there's a lot of ageism there. People are seen as sort of like, you know, you're old, this is part of the aging process, and sort of you're, you know, put away in an institution and out of sight, out of mind. And so I'd really like to really figure out a way to deal with that from a civil rights perspective. And I think that the intersection, too, is it's tricky because you want to make sure that when you're bringing your claims, you're not, you know, diminishing the impact of one form of discrimination over the other. So that's where it's really important to pick the right cases to bring forward. Another potential litigation strategy that I think should be explored is on the drug pricing arena. You know, a lot of times, like, drugs that treat certain conditions are placed really high on the formulary for drug prices, and that has a disparate impact on people with disabilities and chronic conditions. But, you know, the cases that we've seen so far haven't, you know, recognized that, haven't really gone into that disparate impact, and I think that really needs to be pushed. You know, this practice of putting these drugs on higher price formularies is something that also AARP mentioned in its comments to the regulation. Lastly, I think that we need to bring an Administrative Procedures Act challenge to the regulation's exclusion of Medicare Part B. It's nowhere in the text of the statute. So I think that really needs to be challenged because, you know, people who are receiving health services through Medicare Part B, which is going to be more and more people, and also a lot of people with disabilities have access to Medicare, they deserve the right to be free from discrimination as well. And I think that needs to be challenged. But I guess overall, most importantly, other than sort of aggressively litigating, you know, claims under Section 1557, getting creative about the claims that you bring, being very careful about the cases that you choose for test cases to really have an impact, you know, overall, I think we need to save the ACA. There are a lot of gains made toward addressing health disparities that are in jeopardy. A lot of the, you know, the public doesn't know how much of an important a civil rights statute the ACA is, and that it's very important for people with disabilities, but I want to say for everybody. I want to look at this from a prism of, you know, at some point, as Jessica mentioned, like, you know, none of us are healthy according to the definition of the World Health Organization. And if we are for 5 minutes in our life, we won't stay that way. Right? All of us will need health services, we'll need supports. And so you know, I think we should bring it more towards sort of a universal expectation that this is something that should be available to everyone. And if it's available to everyone, it will help those most in need and also those least in need. Thank you.
Thank you, Iris. There has been litigation on the use of psychotropic medication to control inmates of mental hospitals for the criminally insane. I don't know whether that applies to what you're talking about, but I suspect it might. The last of the presenters today is David Machtlet. I hope I said that properly. Senior Policy Analyst of the National Health Law Program. Here you will go. David?
Hello, everyone. Thanks again for the opportunity to speak today. I am a senior policy analyst with the National Health Law Program. My background is in medical anthropology. I have a PhD. I'm also the co-chair for the Health Task Force of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, which we heard about a little bit before, so that was cool. I just want to say we've been through a heck of a difficult year fighting for healthcare. That snowstorm we had yesterday, it was kind of symbolic for me. You know, it's late March in Maryland or DC where I live. We've battened down the hatches and we've ridden out a long, cold winter. And a couple of weeks ago, it felt like maybe spring was kind of just around the corner, but now we're dumped with snow again and saying, not yet, not yet. We got to keep shoveling. So, as Iris and Jessica have already pointed out, the ACA helped to bridge the gap between health law and civil rights law. I will say there are folks in my office who've done a lot of work on 1557, including bringing the complaint on HIV drug copays, where in Florida there were plans that were putting all of their HIV medications into the highest tier of copayments. And there is that provision in the law also about discriminatory benefit design. So I will say in the regulations for 1557, that issue was actually raised as a complaint, and there were changes that happened in Florida due to that complaint. So, but I want to say I'm going to be a Debbie Downer here. I'm going to turn around and tell you that after all of that attempts to bridge these things, we are now facing a whole bunch of potential threats that could erase some of those gains. And some of the gains that we've made, I would call them baby steps towards reducing health disparities. But before I go there, I want to take a minute to think about how the ACA has moved the needle in terms of health disparities. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation, uninsurance rates for Black, Hispanic, and Asian populations have declined faster than they did for whites. They also declined for whites between 2013 and 2015. There are still substantial gaps in coverage between these different populations, but those gaps have gotten smaller, and that's an important step forward. Another Commonwealth-funded study in 2017 found that disparity gaps have decreased across various measures, the uninsurance rates, but also the rates of foregone care due to cost, and the percent of people who have a usual provider. Prior research suggests that kind of coverage gains and changes in these other areas generally translates to better health outcomes. And that also passes the common sense test. But we've also seen coverage drops in Medicaid expansion states being more significant and larger. I want to point out that in the Medicaid expansion, that includes millions of people with significant disabilities, people who maybe didn't meet the strict Social Security criteria for disability or who had not been able to previously qualify for Medicaid for some reason, including a lot of people with behavioral health conditions. As many as 3 in 10 adults in the adult Medicaid expansion have some kind of behavioral health condition that can create barriers. And depending on how you define disability, something north of 1 in 5 expansion adults also live with a significant disability. We've also have millions of others with pre-existing conditions who can now find more affordable health insurance on the ACA marketplace. So then that things were going in the right direction, and then we had this bump in the road. A health landscape changed a little bit in end of 2016. Last year, you know, when we came in, this administration started, it looked like the ACA was going to be repealed and Medicaid would get federal funding limits, or known as per capita caps, that would lead to massive cuts and millions of people losing insurance. Those cuts would have disproportionately affected people with disabilities who rely on Medicaid coverage for medical care and for their long-term care, and I can go into that into Q&A if you want. I won't have time to discuss it right now. Luckily, that hasn't happened, and that's thanks to a huge advocacy surge, including loud voices from the disability community, people in the Hart Senate building getting arrested, made a huge impression and a huge difference. And the threat of major legislative changes right now has subsided for the time being. But, Debbie Downer, we still face big threats from administrative changes, and I'm going to talk about those threats and how they could exacerbate health disparities going forward, and why we need to continue that push until we get to spring. I don't have time for a lot of details on these specific measures. We're happy to talk about them. I've spent a lot of time on them and other people in my organization during Q&A. From the ACA perspective, I would say there's three things to point to: undermining access to coverage, making it harder and more expensive to get covered; policies that undermine the comprehensiveness of coverage, particularly targeting the essential health benefits, which are 10 categories that the ACA said every marketplace plan and small market plan has to cover. And then there's measures that have eroded protections around pre-existing conditions and have lent towards splitting or dividing the risk pool, and I'll talk a little bit about that. On the Medicaid side, the general theme here is that there's been a push in some states to do things that will make it harder to get enrolled and stay enrolled. One of the goals of the ACA was to make Medicaid a little bit simpler. I can never say simple. I tried to say simple, but then I was like, no, it's not. It make it easier to get into. There's a single streamlined application. You're supposed to be able to apply online. They simplified the mechanism for becoming eligible. They got rid of asset tests, which often trip people up, not because they don't have asset, they have too many assets, but because it takes a long time to get all those things together. And every time you add an extra hurdle, someone trips. These new requirements that are mostly going to be going through 1115 waivers, I'm going to talk about them in a little bit. They include things like premiums, lockouts, waiting periods, waivers of non-emergency medical transportation, work requirements, which you might have heard about recently, and even things like time limits on Medicaid coverage, lifetime limits. We also have a spate of new rulemaking. There's a proposed rule out right now that would allow providers to refuse certain kinds of services to people based on their religious and moral exemptions, and expand regulation expands who that applies to. There's rumors of revamping the 1557 regulations, the Medicaid managed care regulations that were finalized last year. There's a whole bunch of other things that are on our plate right now. In terms of the ACA and marketplace stability, what we've seen is really death by a thousand cuts, right? The legislative big proposals didn't work. Now we're seeing other kinds of what you might call sabotage. In terms of premiums enrollment, that first bullet, shortening of the enrollment period to 6 weeks from 3 months, restricting special enrollment periods and who can get those special enrollment periods. There was a massive cut to the outreach and advertising budget, a cut to support for healthcare navigators who help people sign up for insurance. And finally, there was a cutting off of cost-sharing reduction payments, which caused premiums to go up even more. In terms of weakening the EHB, we have a new, there's a proposed rule out, it hasn't been finalized yet, that would change the rules for EHB. And among other things that it would do, number one, it would set a ceiling on plans. So whatever a state had as its essential health benefits in 2017, that's as far as it's going to be able to go. If it wanted to add a new benefit or change a benchmark to a more comprehensive benefit, the state would have to defray those costs if the rule is finalized, as it was said. There's also a new definition for what a lot of ways for states to make their EHB less comprehensive. There are new rules that make it easier to substitute benefits, within a particular EHB category to have lower amounts of coverage. And there's also a new definition of employer-sponsored-based benchmark plan can be. And that is any plan that has an enrollment over 5,000 people. So you could have an outlier plan that has very low benefits that still has 5,000 people and could then be considered a base benchmark plan across the 50 states. So that's a dangerous thing. There's also broadening access to things called association health plans, which are sort of like a health plan offered by a farm bureau or something, making it easier to access those plans, and those plans are not subject to EHB. They're regulated as large group plans. And there's other things. Finally, in terms of splitting the risk pool, we had legislative proposals that would have gone back to the pre-ACA days of high-risk pools in insurance, and that has a very checkered history in terms of leaving people with extremely high, people with pre-existing conditions, limiting coverage, capping enrollment, and for those people who got in had extremely high out-of-pocket expenses. But basically that association health plan rule and another rule about short-term health coverage is another sort of end around the ACA that would allow those plans to offer skimpier coverage, which siphons off healthier enrollees by giving them lower premiums for what doesn't amount for really comprehensive coverage. And doing things like, say, not offering mental health coverage or not offering prescription drug coverage on a plan, someone who has a pre-existing condition is not going to be attracted to those plans. That leaves a sicker risk pool in the health marketplace, which means those premiums go up even higher, and you have a sort of de facto high-risk pool. What are the implications for people with disabilities and chronic conditions? Well, that should be pretty obvious. Higher out-of-pocket costs is one, more difficulty getting and keeping coverage, and really returning to the days before the pre-ACA when healthcare was not covered by these non-discrimination laws, so breaking that link. In terms of Medicaid, I'm really going to focus on Medicaid expansion waivers. This is something my organization and I have done a lot of work on. We're currently involved in litigation in Kentucky. But I want to give a little bit about why these matter for people with disabilities, because a lot of the media coverage of this is, well, people with disabilities are excluded from that, or the Medicaid expansion is not, there's a misnomer that it's something meant for adults who don't have disabilities. As I explained, that's not true when you look at the ground. We have millions of people with disabilities who previously fell through the cracks in Medicaid, and in those states that have expanded Medicaid, have finally been able to get coverage, especially people with mental health conditions and behavioral health conditions who previously had trouble with the disability definitions. So what is an 1115 waiver? So the statute says this has existed since 1962. It's been around for a long time. It is meant for a way for Medicaid to test novel, innovative approaches and allow states or allows the secretary to waive certain Medicaid rules in order to test those pilots. So it was pilot demonstration programs. There are guardrails on what the secretary can approve. One of those is that it has to have a demonstration value. It has to have an experimental value. It's supposed to be likely to promote the objectives of the Medicaid program, which basically are to furnish medical assistance. And it is limited in scope. In other words, you can only waive things for the time and for the reasons necessary to carry out that pilot program. And it's limited to things that are in Section 1902 of the Social Security Act, which is a huge provision that covers a lot of different things in Medicaid, but not everything. Historically, the scope of 1115s has gone way beyond the notion of what it was originally intended for, to be just a demonstration program. There's some elements, managed care is a good example, family planning is another example of things that were tested first and eventually moved into the statute as state plan options. That hasn't been the case in a state like Arizona, which came into Medicaid program in 1981 or 82 with a Medicaid demonstration. That is now its whole state Medicaid program, and it has been running that demonstration experiment since 1982. So now about a third of all Medicaid spending actually goes through 1115. This is a huge subset of the Medicaid program. And that's why it's really important to pay attention to what's going on in Medicaid expansions. So what we have is some states that didn't want to accept the straight Medicaid expansion that was in the ACA. Mostly these are Republican states with Republican governors or Republican legislatures who wanted to do something their own thing. We have premiums provisions like premiums. Disenrollment if you fail to pay the premiums, with a lockout in some states, waivers of retroactive eligibility, waivers of non-emergency medical transportation, things with new efforts with punitive healthy behavior incentives. And what we've seen is that every time one state has gotten one waiver for premiums, the next state that came in asked for that waiver plus something more, right? And so we've moved beyond those things, and now we've got lifetime limits, proposals for drug testing. These have not been approved yet. And then a work requirement, which has been now approved in three different states, Arkansas, Kentucky, and Indiana. This was previously rejected under the prior administration. Why are work requirements and these things important for people with disabilities? They make it harder to stay on Medicaid. And I'm going to look at work requirements a little bit more. The way that this is sold, it's people who can work should work, and people with disabilities are going to be excluded from this. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that people are skeptical of that claim. Right. So number one, people in the Medicaid expansion, it's very hard to screen for disabilities, and most states, don't have a screen in place right now, so they haven't even developed that, let alone whether you develop an adequate screen and how you're going to do that to get people to flag. What we've seen with the approvals so far, there's a definition in the regulations called medically frail, and people who are medically frail in the Medicaid expansion are exempt from work requirements. However, there's a vast disparity in who gets flagged as medically frail. In Arkansas, for example, the state has had a medically frail screen, and it has about a 7.5% of the people in their expansion were declared medically frail. In Indiana, it's more like 21%. In other states, it could be higher. So this is a huge difference, and someone who doesn't fall, get flagged for some reason or doesn't qualify for that medically frail exemption is going to have to complete those work requirements. Even someone who's exempt is going to have to go through that process, and that process itself adds red tape, it adds difficulty, and anytime you add those hurdles, what happens? People lose coverage. What our experience has been looking at other programs that have put work requirements in place, like TANF, is that there's been a disproportionate effect on people with disabilities, people who have barriers to finding employment. There's no added supports in the work requirements that have been approved so far. There has been language saying that they would accommodate people with disabilities, but you're not talking about a new supported employment program. Kentucky has a requirement that it make a good faith effort to connect people with employment opportunities. So what you have is even people who are complying or who should be exempt are going to have more trouble getting exempt. You're adding a huge amount of bureaucracy to the system that we already complain about has way too much red tape. And what the effect of this is going to be is extreme high costs on Medicaid agencies, a high administrative burden, and you're also going to have people with disabilities who are losing their coverage. In Kentucky, the state itself estimated that 95,000 people would lose coverage through implementation of its waiver, of all of those waivers I was talking about, including premiums and other things. In Indiana, its actuary estimated 25,000 people would lose coverage due to the work requirement. And that didn't include an analysis of all the people who are going to fall by the wayside because of the added verification requirements. So the big message here is that we need to be paying attention to what's going on in these states. What can you guys do? The first thing is that we're not in an environment where we're likely to get a lot of headway at the federal with the administration. So the key action here is at the state level, knowing what's happening in the 50 states. There's a lot of states that have work requirements and other 1115 demonstrations that are on that are ongoing right now. We need people to come out. Apply media pressure, do advocacy with their elected officials. There's been successful advocacy in Kansas, where legislators have pulled back a work requirement because of pressure about how poorly run their previous demonstration was on Medicaid managed care. And that has stalled out, at least for the time being, that push for a work requirement. And I give a lot of credit to the disability advocates in that state and others who've pushed for that to go. We need comments in providing expertise from a disability perspective on how these kind of provisions will have a disproportionate effect on people with disabilities, people who have extra barriers to work. And finally, there's the litigation angle. I'm happy to talk about that a little bit. We've brought a claim against the state of against HHS. In the D.C. District Court for the approval of the Kentucky waiver that happened in January, and of course the subsequent approvals we're looking at very closely, and we'll see what happens. With that, I want to say people with disabilities face more barriers to accessing care than other groups. And these barriers are multiplied for people with disabilities who experience other discrimination due to race, ethnicity, age, and sexual orientation. I think that intersectionality is really important to think about in our work. Though the major legislative push to repeal the ACA and cap Medicaid is now on the back burner, we're still in great danger of losing some of the gains that to end non-discrimination protections in the ACA and in Medicaid. These protections are really important tools to help promote policies that can move us toward more health equity in our system. The immediate focus has to be on limiting these threats, like to Medicaid expansion waivers and other administrative changes, comments on regulations, getting those things on the books. That also helps out with litigation. The voices of the disability community have been absolutely crucial in these in holding back hugely damaging legislative changes to Medicaid, and that attention and effort is still needed as those administrative efforts to undermine the laws continue. Hopefully, spring is around the corner.
Well, thank you, David. I appreciate your comments. A Debbie Downer, you say. Why do we always blame it on Debbie? maybe it should be a David Downer.
Yeah, that's what my colleagues say.
You know, everybody wants to know about us in certain cases. Whenever I go to fly somewhere, somebody wants to know if I have a disability. I have a great reluctance to tell them because they already have an opinion about what I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to do before I show up. So the argument that I always, the tension is, do I tell them ahead of time what I expect and what I need, or do I just go there and do the best I can at the time because maybe I won't get a pre-existing set of thoughts that I run into. And what you've talked about is whether or not we should disclose. And of course, the question is, how are we going to disclose and how are we going to be labeled? amongst other things. So I can appreciate your David Downer status these days. We do have time for questions, and I can think of a couple of hundred. Why don't you guys start? Who would like to speak? Please identify yourself. We have microphones out there, one standing on a stand and one that's portable, so probably we can get to you. Al?
Hi, good morning.
You're not Al.
Sorry. My name is Caitlin Parton. I'm at the Massachusetts PNA.
Go ahead.
I was wondering where the 1557 suits that have been filed so far have been filed, where they've taken place, thanks.
So I can't remember all of them, except I remember when I was looking through the cases, there were a disproportionate amount filed in the Eastern District of Louisiana. And those cases, a lot of them were motions to like the judges didn't dismiss. So that's where I've seen the most cases, but I'd have to go back and look, and I can take a quick look over my notes and get back to you on with more specifics. I have them right here on my computer. But I remember noticing that going, wow, you know, this is a hot spot for Section 1557 claims.
Al Elia? You're not the one, apparently. I thought you were seeking the floor, but apparently not. Who's next?
This is... Well, hopefully you can hear me anyway. This is Greg Kerr from Bradley-Steen Levy. I was just curious, and I think I know the answer to this question in some respects, but what might be any potential role for, like, healthcare organizations, hospital groups, trade groups, and things like that to try to... you know, add something to the conversation that might be helpful. I mean, I know that there are some ways in which, you know, these groups might be might stand in the way of progress, but is there any potential, you know, opportunity for them to be an ally?
Are you talking sort of in terms of reducing health disparities in general, in terms?
Right.
Okay.
So I think as a general matter, so like on the healthcare provider side, what can healthcare providers and those kinds of entities in that industry do? And I think recognizing people with disabilities as a meaningful population that they are serving, right? So in the context of healthcare in this country, right, we are, you know, we do have a kind of a consumer-driven model, right? So there's actually a great market for, you know, medical device companies to develop better, more accessible equipment, right? Also, too, this is not something that relates to disability, but certain healthcare providers get reputations for better serving obese individuals, and then they get a larger share of patients coming to them. Right, so you can imagine a particular, you know, provider or institution being really accessible, really disability friendly, and individuals with disabilities going out and saying, you know, I had a positive experience here, right? And then that's something that, you know, generates better care, and it's something that is to the benefit of both parties. So I would just say that, you know, acknowledge people with disabilities, acknowledge their needs, specifically in the context of healthcare, and then meet their needs, right? Because, you know, I mean, the status of insurance aside, right, they need this access, and there's the opportunity for mutual benefit, I think.
And if I could just add to that, I would say try to work on doing a better training, cultural competency training of all your staff and everyone, not just the direct care providers, but everyone who works at the hospital. And what I'm seeing in these cases, and you know what I'm sure many of you have experienced, is that people just don't get it. They don't get what you need. They don't take the time to understand. They don't really want to understand. They're sort of like, this is my job. This is what I'm told to do. So if I need an interpreter versus whatever machine you have for me that doesn't work for me, there's a reason I need to get me the interpreter. Don't tell me this is the only thing I can offer you. You're not understanding my needs. And I think that's a lack of training, a lack of cultural competency. And in some sense, it's a lack of empathy. But of course, you know, it's better to get at it with the training and the cultural competency aspect of it, I think, because I don't necessarily think that people who are, like, on the direct lines, you know, are necessarily, you know, they're not bad people. They're just trying to do their job the way they've been told they have to do it. So let's change what we tell them about how they do it.
And then just one possible follow-up question is, with respect to some of the regulatory efforts and things that are coming down that you've all spoken about, where are those trade groups, where are the, you know, the medical providers, the insurance companies weighing in?
I'll speak in terms of the Medicaid expansion. The push to get more states to do Medicaid expansion and to accept those funds has been an experience with lots of what I might call strange bedfellows. Like, you know, the hospital associations, rural hospital associations are on board in many states. And I think that that's been actually a really powerful way to lobby states. And I think in terms of some of the more damaging potential proposals for 1115 waivers, there's been a broad coalition of groups, not just sort of your progressive groups, but managed care plans. You know, AHIP, as the Association of Health Insurance Plans, has written letters that have been really positive, had positive influence on a lot of the regulatory on some of the comments, but also in terms of getting states to accept that Medicaid expansion. It's good for states' economies. There's a lot of evidence of the beneficial outcomes, and that also helps get more people with disabilities covered, and at a macro level, that's really important. The other things, attention to manage long-term services and supports, that's been a big problem, and we are working a lot on. I've done a fair amount of work on that in with the managed care regulations, improving accountability and oversight and that kind of thing. And there's been a lot of plans involved in those discussions in Washington, D.C., reaching out to the disability community to talk about how to do that better. So I think that's another place where that is happening.
Also, too, the access board guidelines, right? That's a collaborative process too, where the desire is to get multiple stakeholders in and to talk about, you know, needs, but also the ability to meet the needs, right? So that's a situation where you would have healthcare providers and medical device producers, you know, talking to people with disabilities in terms of, you know, okay, what are your needs, and then, you know, what are the sorts of designs and things that we can create to meet those needs. And I think that's a great model for thinking about a lot of these issues, right, that we need to be having these conversations to really enact change.
Great. Thank you very much.
So one of you said that you have to show intentional, I think it's what you said, discrimination, not animus, but intent. Is knowledge enough? I mean, all of the providers that signed the contracts, the law requires non-discrimination, the contracts require it. Is that enough? Which one of you said that?
That was me. This is Iris. Yes. I mean, I think, you know, it's enough to show, you knew the person had a disability and you denied the person equal access or equal enjoyment to the services. So, you know, I pointed that out because when we think of intent, you know, we immediately go to they meant to do something bad to the person, right? But that's not how the law interprets that term in this context. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Who's next?
This is Daniel Hodges with one of the Pearson mentees.
Yes, sir.
And one of the things we haven't covered all that extensively is for those of us who are blind but also have other disabilities or other health conditions, helping care providers distinguish the symptoms or issues that are directly attributable to that disability from those that are not. For instance, something can coexist in a person but could not be correlated. Yet, you know, my case, for instance, I have had issues with walking ever since I was a child, but it took literally decades to finally be able to educate providers on the orthopedic issues that I have that were directly causing that versus trying to misattribute those issues from blindness and the direct things there. So I guess how do we go about teaching providers how to separate what may or may not be legitimately related versus what is simply coexisting and almost coincidental in a sense?
Sure, so I think some of that issue goes back to the cultural competency kinds of things that Iris was talking about, right? Just providing better education for medical professionals in terms of how to deal with individuals with disabilities and the kinds of questions that are appropriate, the kinds of questions that aren't appropriate. And really, like all things, you know, it's great to get folks at the institutional professional level, but really the best place to get them is in terms of education, right? So just better educating our doctors in medical school about disability and treatment and how to treat a whole person in a way that actually reflects their experience, right? And not in a way that builds in these kinds of biases and assumptions about functioning and relationships and things. So I think personally, you know, we need to better educate our doctors about how to deal with individuals with disabilities. And in the process of doing that, I think we will be able to de-bias folks.
Very good. Who is seeking the floor?
May I?
You may. Your
Thank
name?
Thank you. My name is Beth Pepper. I'm with the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division, but I'm actually here in my personal capacity. I have to say that.
We were thinking of asking you a few questions.
My question goes to this issue of intersectionality that I think, David, you may have mentioned at the end. I'm just curious as to this, the relationship between some of the topics you described and the type of discrimination that persons of color experience in healthcare, and whether there are analogies or parallels, and whether or not the, you know, jurisprudence with regard to access for persons with color is in a better place than for people with disabilities, or whether there are benefits to looking at that case law, and whether or not there has been any, you know, way in which the issues pertaining to people with disabilities can borrow from or be informed by, or in somehow that area might be instructive.
So I think that is possible, and that is the reason why a lot of times multiple claims are brought, right? It's a race discrimination and disability discrimination, sex discrimination and disability discrimination. And the problem is that what you're going to get is judges interpreting what they think the discrimination is really about. And it's about also, like, what kind of evidence can you bring that race was a factor versus disability, and then there's going to be that weighing of, was it more disability or was it more race? Or was it both? I mean, it just depends on the facts of the case. I think that, you know, it's good that we have Section 1557 and that we already have discrimination standards, legal standards, right, to go by based on the pre-existing statutes. But in a way, that's also a limitation. And I wish that 1557 would have been written with its own set of standards explicitly, and that it wouldn't have been cabined to what's already. And there's an argument that it isn't cabined to that, right? And there's a section in the statute that says that basically that nothing in the statute shall be interpreted to provide any less protections than current civil rights statutes. So the argument is that it's the floor, not the ceiling. But what we have is, you know, judges saying, well, we already have guidance here in all this case law with these civil rights statutes that have been litigated. And Section 1557 references and incorporates them, so that's what we're going to go by. I don't necessarily think that's what the statute says. It just says is a floor. So that's really an opportunity there to argue for more protections, because there's a different, I think, and specific intent behind Section 1557 is recognizing healthcare activity and healthcare services as deserving of special protection.
Also, too, if you have sort of a pure intersectionality claim where you really can't parse out the two different categories and you're stuck with different standards, you know, which standard are you going to proceed under, the one that references the Rehab Act or the, you know, age? And that's,
I think, hasn't been addressed.
It's a problem for judges to figure that out. But I think that that in and of itself, if you could get intersectionality kinds of cases and then say that, you know, this Section 1557 is greater than the sum of its parts, right, that it's actually intended to do more, and we want to take the sort of the best part of these underlying statutes, not the worst part of them and how they've been interpreted, and create, you know, a better, more meaningful, more robust healthcare civil right for these categories.
Other questions?
Hi. Oh.
Sylvia, you behind you.
Hi, I was just behind you, actually. And I will hand that microphone over right away, but I just have it right now. This is Sylvia Yee with Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund. And I mean, just partly building on the question that was already asked, and I have two parts. One was whether on looking at 1557 as a sum of its parts, whether it's a way to get around solely by reason of, because it's there and it seems to speak against intersectional interpretation of 504, but again, with that as a floor only and not a ceiling, maybe there's a way to get past that. The other 1557 question I had was, I mean, we've been thinking a lot about the benefit design aspect of 1557 and how benefit design and discrimination in benefit design is explicitly included in the EHB regulations.
Yeah.
And wondering a little bit about the timing of something like that. And this is a way, will 1557 allow us to get around that classic car parts analogy? You can go to a camera store. The ADA means that you can get into the camera store, but you can't look at the cameras in there. And the fact that 1557 maybe allows us to look at actual insurance. And there's such a history of insurance discrimination, everything from we cover cochlear, we cover you getting a cochlear implant, but we won't cover you getting the services and supports and devices you may need as a person who's deaf to function in the world. And we've been looking at this a lot with regard to durable medical equipment and a lot of historic discriminatory practices in insurance about what's covered, what's not, and limitations that are placed on wheelchair coverage, et cetera. So I think my question is about the timing of such things. Here we are with threats to, I mean, I don't think insurance companies and plans are necessarily ever thought of as sympathetic parties. But if that was ever such a time, now is probably a time when CRS payments have been done away with, and there's a question about the viability of insurance markets, et cetera. When is a good time to raise this somewhat second generation aspect of 1557 to really tackle and try and get at the benefit design of insurance and how it discriminates against people with disabilities?
Do your best.
I would say that part of what makes Section 1557 exciting as a provision is the explicit application to health insurance in a way that in the longer Law Review article where I go through, you know, the ways in which various civil rights statutes have failed, right? This is a way in which civil rights statutes have failed by saying, like, oh, we all have equal access to the same plan, and so therefore you have meaningful access, so what's your problem? And then looking at the fact that, you know, the actual coverage is something that falls terribly short for certain individuals. So I cannot speak to the timing, but I, at least in my understanding of what makes this provision exciting and why we needed it, was we precisely needed it to get at the kinds of things that you're describing, the kinds of second generation discrimination, right? So you're not having outward exclusions, but you're having this kind of, you know, disparate impact, and we're building in biases, right, about in terms of, you know, what's the appropriate way to approach a given disability, right? Coverage for the cochlear implant and not other kinds of things. And so I the timing with the ACA under threat, I think that, you know, 1557 is under threat. So maybe not now, but this is just one of the reasons why we need to fight to keep the ACA intact. Is that's going to prove to be a really, really important aspect of Section 1557, and it's something that it's really important that we save.
I just want to say quickly, that's where I think the disparate impact theory of liability could come into play. And then also quickly, I think that some of the sex discrimination cases with gender dysphoria and different benefits providing, you know, like breast reconstruction to one sex and not the other, and for one purpose and not the other, I think that case law, as it's developed, may help sort of build those theories in a disability, more strictly disability context. But it's all sort of emerging, but the timing really is key.
I don't have a lot to add, since I wish I had my colleague Wayne or Jen Lav here to talk. But I will say, I think, you know, there is the open possibility of this regulation being it's being actively reviewed right now in a way, in terms of timing. It could be a use it or lose it kind of thing. Like, there are cases right now that are built on 1557 as a statute, and others that are really the national injunction is really about one part of the regulation, the current regulations. So, you know, getting a case law that is based on the statute might be helpful in the context of that regulation being rethought. That's just a thought. So I think, but being thoughtful about what cases to bring and talking to the people who are doing that work is really important in coming up with that strategy.
One more question only.
Just quickly, I wanted to follow up on Caitlin's question. The disability claims have been brought in New York, Louisiana, South Carolina, and Pennsylvania. But a lot of other Section 1557 claims have been brought all over the country. Wisconsin, Minnesota, California, D.C., Iowa, Illinois, Texas. There's been like six in the Northern District of Texas. A lot of them are sex discrimination. So it's broad. Sorry to interrupt. Next question.
My name is Riley Sloan. My question is directed at David. So you had referenced the current attacks on Medicaid coverage, and I was wondering if you know if any of those laws, like the one in Arkansas, if they allow for homemaker services to help an individual obtain work credits for Medicaid coverage, and if you are aware of any cases in which an individual has used homemaker services to temporarily obtain Medicaid coverage in our current political environment.
To give an honest answer, I don't know about that particular case. I'm happy to follow up with you and do that research and get back to you. Why don't you come talk to me offline and I'll give you my card and we can talk.
Okay, I appreciate your presentations, and a matter of significant need is outlined in what you've said. So we have to make plans to have strategies to pursue the objectives you've outlined here. Thank you very much to the three of you.